Golden State Media Concepts Technology Podcast covers everything tech. The hottest mobile phones, tablets, games. We review it, rate it, test it. Whether you're Microsoft or Apple, Android or iPhone, we'll give it to you
again and again.
Black and white. The Golden State Media Concepts Technology Podcast.
Welcome to Golden State Media Concepts Technology Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Charney. Today we're going to be talking about a Canadian startup that is removing CO2 from the air. The new design choice of Nintendo's new console could cost it with third parties. Scientists develop an amazing USB stick that can perform an HIV test. Dish is losing no more subscribers. And Amazon is getting serious about video streaming. Now we're going to just kick off right into it. A Canadian startup is removing CO2 to the air and turning it into pellets, like a pellet stove pellet. Now, a Canadian startup called Carbon Engineering has doing a pilot program to suck CO2 out of the atmosphere and turn it into pellets that can either be used for fuel or stored underground for later use. Well, the test facility so far has only extracted 10 tons of CO2 since it launched back in June. It's operating with help from construction of a $200 million commercial plant in 2017, which is expected to extract 1 million tons a day, the equivalent of taking 100 cars off the road every year, and it plans to start selling its CO2-based synthetic fuel in 2018. So pretty much it sounds like what it's doing is it's sucking all the bad stuff out of there and getting enough out of it that somehow it's able to compress it into a pellet. Now, my main question is, if you burn it, how clean is it? Is it going to cause more pollution? And if it's doing that, what's the point of sucking out of the air if you're going to put it back in? It is now possible to take CO2 out of the atmosphere and use it as a feedstock with hydrogen to produce new zero-emission fuel, company chief executive Adrian Corliss told the AFP. So I guess it's somehow going to be combined with something to make a zero-emission fuel. Still not sure what's the pollution going to be. It says zero emissions, but there's no such thing. There's always going to be cost. For example, hydrogen cars actually make water. Funded by private investors, including billionaires Bill Gates and oil sands financier Murray Edwards, Carbon Engineering is not the only company in the world to intent on solving our carbon dioxide problems, but it claims to be the first to demonstrate how its technology can be scaled up to have both actual environmental impacts and commercial potential. Now, they're going to be doing something a little bit different. Now, there are technologies that will take the CO2 and other chemicals directly out of the smoke in the smokestack. What they're going to be doing is their direct air capture plant will deal with everyday carbon emissions from buildings, transportation, agriculture emissions from sources you just can't otherwise capture. Honestly, it sounds like it's going to be a giant air filter and it's just going to suck everything in. Still pretty neat idea, though. Now, the plant they're using right now is still pilot, so they're basically testing it. They're probably seeing, okay, what works, what doesn't work. So what do you guys think? I mean, in theory, this is going to be a great idea. It sounds amazing. I'm still skeptical on the so-called, oh, it's going to be zero emission. Now, there's no such thing really as a zero emission car, in the traditional sense especially. So what they're saying really is they're going to combine the CO2 with hydrogen and make a clean fuel. Usually out of hydrogen, when you do it in vehicles, you get water. It's still an emission. It's probably a healthier emission that you get coming from cars today. But it's still an emission. We're going to have to keep an eye on this because right now it's a pilot plant. So it looks like they're going to be doing more in the future. So we'll see what happens when they build their bigger plant. Now, we're going to switch topics on a little bit to Nintendo's latest console. And have you guys heard of it yet? It's called the Nintendo Switch, or at least that's what I've heard it called so far. And it's being touted, and I quote, as the portable next generation console, unquote. And it kind of looks like the Wii U giant controller. You know, it's that one that has that like tablet in the middle. But the Switch part, what it does, it allows you to take off the controls in the left or right, or put it on and play on the go. So pretty much it's a dock with a tablet. I don't know. It looks like a gimmick. I mean, the Wii and the Wii U were a gimmick, but it's a gimmick that worked. This one right here, I have a feeling is going to be a major flop with third-party developers, especially on people who make accessories for things. Now, it looks like Nintendo's business is still heavily... Nintendo's business is still heavily dependent on controlling its own platform ecosystem and derives roughly half of its revenue from hardware sales. Holy crap, that's a lot. Half its revenue? While combined sales of its Wii and 3DS gaming platforms are on track to come up more than 150 million units short of combined sales for the Wii and DS platform, Nintendo needs a turnaround hit in its hardware specs. I'm not sure if this is going to do it. Now, do anybody out there actually know anybody who has a Wii or a Wii U? I have a Wii U at home. I had no interest in buying the Wii U, so I don't know. It just this may be the end of Nintendo as we know it. Now, Nintendo's kind of famous for making odd format choices. The Nintendo 3D or the Game Boy 3D or whatever it was called was one of them. Now, apparently, it's also going to go with a flash-based cartridge instead of using the traditional Blu-ray player, which Xbox and PlayStation use. Well, the cost of cartridges have come down in recent years. They still cost more than optical disc, which means the releasing of games on the Switch could be less profitable than on other consoles. Given the importance of minimizing piracy and Nintendo's history of using its own formats for consoles, it's likely that the system will use a proprietary variant of flash cartridge technology that could make a move that would probably add expense. If Nintendo can't keep the cost of cartridges low for publishers, the company could once again find its gaming hardware without third-party support. Which is pretty much what happened, honestly, to the Wii and Wii U. There's not a lot of third-party games. A lot of the titles are their own games. More troubling than the use of the cartridges is what the Switch status as a console handheld hybrid suggests. In an era where big publishers are counting on the benefit of high-end margin digital sales to recoup development costs and drive profits, both PS4 and Xbox One ships in versions featuring 500GB and 1TB hard drives, which substantial storage space needed to accumulate large file size of today's games. It's unlikely that Nintendo's Switch will have comparable onboard storage. Pretty much, you're going to have a portable console with less storage. I mean, I'm not really surprised, to be completely honest. I really don't get the point of this. I actually think it's going to be a flop. Nintendo, if you're out there, I have a suggestion. Go back to what copy PlayStation, copy Xbox, you know, use the Wii U controllers, or matter of fact, how about becoming just a developer? How about put, you know, Mario Brothers and Mario Kart and all their other games you make, how about putting them on Xbox and PlayStation? How about a PlayStation or Xbox-based Pokemon game? Or at least an actual Pokemon game that doesn't require you to walk around like Pokemon Go. There's so much more you can do. Look at Sega. Sega is still around solely based on the fact that they realized their consoles were not going to make it and compete against the Xbox and PlayStation. And whether you want to admit it, PlayStation and Xbox are king until one of them say, hey, this costs too much. Which, by the way, they won't. Because even if you don't buy the game and you buy the console, there's still so much more you can do with it. You've got a Blu-ray player. You've got a portable streaming device. You can access Netflix and Hulu. Xbox lets you watch TV through it using an extra HDMI cable. So what are you going to do, Sony, to compete against it? Because obviously, using a proprietary flash-based storage ain't going to get you anywhere. It's going to be ridiculously expensive. You're only going to have first-party games, because I doubt you're going to see other games for it, because there's already not a lot of ones that I know of for the Wii U. You know, I think there's Call of Duty on the Wii and Wii U, but how easy can it actually be to play? The first thing I always wanted to do when I bought the Wii or the Wii U, if I bought a Wii or Wii U, would to get the standard controllers and ditch the stupid wand and nunchuck thing. I just don't get it. No, granted, maybe I'm just an old guy and don't really get the point of it, but it's just not fun to me. I don't understand why they want to use this weird controller. And by the way, Microsoft and PlayStation counting their cameras as a controller or their movement controllers, it's going to be a flop. I mean, the only reason why I think they're going to do it now is going to be for the VR. And for VR, maybe that's a lot handier but it sure is awful to use. I just don't get it. And I think it's going to be a major letdown. I would be happier if there was a Pokemon game, PlayStation. Matter of fact, if there's a Zelda game for the Xbox. I'm saying what you should do, ditch your console, make a 4K Link game. I mean, excuse me, a 4K Zelda game or this amazing, beautiful Technicolor Rainbow Mario game. There's just so much more you could do. Ditch your freaking console. Or, I don't know, how about do something for me and my generation? How about remake the NES? I guarantee I would buy one. And I'm not talking about this little console that you made and you're calling the NES. I want a full-on console that plays my cartridges I've had for the last 30 years. So come on, Nintendo. Wake up and please. You're going to have to change or you're going to go out of business. There's nothing to fight or no quibbling. You're failing. Your Nintendo DSs and all this stuff just does not compare to cell phones, which everybody has. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, your thing was king because portable gaming were horrible. When you can do almost 4K video on a cell phone? Come on. What is a 3DS? I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, to go on that little rant. When we come back, we're going to be talking about an interesting piece of kit that helps you test for HIV.
Want to find out what movies to go see? Then check out the GSMC Movie Podcast. It's your ticket to the latest movies, whether it's a new blockbuster event, romantic, comedy, or action flick. This show has got it all covered. They talk some what to go see now. Don't bother. What's hot on Netflix and everything in between? That's GSMCpodcast.com/movie-podcast. When it's all about the movies, it has to be this new show. Don't forget to like them on Facebook and follow them on Twitter. Visit GSMCpodcast.com for more info.
HIV run rampant. When it comes to an HIV test, a drop of blood on a USB stick may be all patients need in the near future. Scientists at the Imperial College in London developed a device that helped, with help of the medical testing community, DNA Electronics, that detects HIV's levels in the bloodstream and creates a signal that can be read using a computer or handheld gadget. This disposable testing units could be used to help HIV patients monitor the treatment as well as improve how doctors manage the virus in remote locations. Now, my first thought on this is on remote locations where, honestly, HIV tests are hard and long drawn out. You could test people by plugging something in, doing a few things, and boom, okay, this is what you've got to do. Because, honestly, education is key. If somebody has HIV, you have to tell them because they're going to have to do certain steps to help themselves. This is amazing. I'm generally thrilled. If this can help the community, the AIDS community and people from getting the disease, this is amazing. And I know you can't tell how excited I am, but trust me, this is amazing. The compact device monitors the amount of HIV virus that's present in the patient's bloodstream, a measurement that is essential in keeping tabs on how effective treatment is in battling the virus. Monitoring the amount of virus that's present in the bloodstream can let doctors know if a patient stopped taking their medicine or if the current course of action has stopped working. Researchers are also hoping the technology can be used to test for hepatitis and other viruses. See, this is also another amazing thing. I keep saying amazing, but I'm still godsmacked you can do this. If you can test for AIDS and Ebola, hepatitis, imagine what you can test in early stages of diseases. Because, ladies and gentlemen, as everybody knows, is the earlier you get it, the faster it's going to become. Now imagine if somehow they can do this and detect cancer. The USB is, the only problem apparently is it's not very accurate, but it can offer results on HIV's levels in less than 30 minutes. So at least what this could be is kind of a quick and dirty test for HIV. You can test for it, okay, this person has it, let's do a bunch more blood tests, see where it is. I mean, at least you give person the knowledge and then you can go on from there. I mean, this was just, I remember reading somewhere, doesn't it take like a week to get that test? So, driven by mobile phone chip, the gadget only needs a small amount of blood to perform its analysis when the HIV virus is detected in the blood sample. So it sounds like it's kind of like a glucose monitor in a way, how it's battery powered and all. It does one thing and one thing only. It's granted probably a little bit more complicated than, you know, your blood sugar level detector. The signals then transmitted ready for a program or a computer that can read the signals. I don't know. I mean, I think this is amazing. What do you guys think? I really do think they need to make this and make it cheaper and send it out to doctors everywhere, worldwide. I mean, you imagine how you can help people? Now, my philosophy and stuff like this is the same philosophy I have when it comes to green technology gadgets. Is if you're going to make it, you got to make it convenient, easy to use, and where people won't necessarily go outside of their lifestyle. And the reason why I say that is, because people don't necessarily like going out of their routine. So if you have something that's simple and easy to use and doesn't take up much time, people will more likely go for the testing. Or cars, for example. I'm a true believer in green technology for cars. I love the idea of electric car. But unless you do it for its convenient and chargers are available, nobody's going to do it. Like the United States, I think Obama just recently signed something. There's going to be a corridor of some highway or freeway somewhere that's going to have EV chargers for electric vehicles. I think that's amazing. Now, granted, right now, most of the time those are empty, but imagine in a world where those are everywhere. So back in the day, a lot of the electric vehicles, for example, had a 200 to 300 mile limitation at best. So imagine imagine in today's world you can go 600 miles on a charge. I actually don't know how long you can go, but imagine. So every 600 miles, there's a little thing you can pull off on the road, you know, charge your car for 30 minutes to an hour and get going. You there, and what you do then is you, instead of having it powered by the grid, you put a bunch of solar panels, and then you have some batteries. It's completely off the grid. You're charging people. You're less carbon in the atmosphere, and it's not that inconvenient. You know, I mean, somebody could grab, you know, you could do a picnic, have benches, have vending machines. You're not affecting people's lifestyles, and that's honestly what green technology should be about. I do know some people in the past who have been friends of mine that don't mind going out of their way and being inconvenienced by green technology. Me, on the other hand, my life is so driven by having to be places at certain times and I don't have the time to go out of my way. I'm not necessarily using green technology because right now it doesn't match my lifestyle. Now, this would totally match my lifestyle. I could adjust what I'm doing so I can say, okay, we're going to stop here for an hour and let's grab a few snacks, you know, toss the ball with a kid type of thing. This is amazing. Now, the other thing I would say with green technology, and we talked about this before, is green housing. Now, imagine an era where you can have housing tracts that are completely powered by solar panels. Now, I've recently read an announcement, I apologize because I don't remember actually where I read it, where a company is producing like composite tiles that are actual solar panels. Imagine that. Instead of having these giant solar panels on your roof, if your whole roof was a solar panel. They've had stuff like this before, and I don't think the company that originally did it is around, or there's a bunch of them, but imagine that. Imagine a whole housing project that instead of being connected by the grid, each one has its own solar panel. They have community batteries. You have a whole area that's not even on the grid, that's powered by itself. Matter of fact, they could sell it back to AT&T or, you know, Ma and Pa Kettle Electric Company, for example. It's a great future. I love green technology, but like I said, the key thing is it cannot take people out of their lifestyle. People don't like being inconvenienced. Is it bad? I don't know. You and I could make an argument how that's bad. Personally, I find it kind of annoying that I got to go out of my routine, even a little bit. And I know life is kind of like, well, you got to go with the flow. I guarantee if they did what I'm talking about, you wouldn't even notice it. You wouldn't be inconvenienced. You wouldn't be irritated. Matter of fact, the only time you'd probably notice something was wrong was maybe when a battery blows up in the communal banks somewhere. I'm just a big fan of this whole thing. I like wind farms. I like solar panels. Anything, matter of fact, even that CO2 thing we talked about, if they can figure out how to turn that into fuel like they said they can, imagine powering power plants with just carbon that they drew out of the atmosphere. I mean, this is amazing technology. And this is kind of what this podcast is all about. It's all about just technology that is out there that interests us. Now, we talk about cell phones and tablets. We talk about a lot of things, but this, to me, is the future. Now, we're going to talk about tablets. Is what are your guys' perfect tablets? Now, one of my favorite tablets I really do like is the Surface product by Microsoft. My mom has one, and it's a neat piece of kit. I wouldn't actually mind getting one. I've been thinking with the idea of maybe getting one of those instead of a laptop, because I know I talked about how I wanted one of the new MacBooks and how I was really disappointed that the fact you can only go with 16 gigabytes. Well, granted, you're not going to do a whole lot of video editing on a Microsoft Surface. Matter of fact, I don't know if you can do any. But if I'm going to get something that doesn't have what I want the portability I want. And the Microsoft Surface is basically just a giant tablet that's running a full version of Windows. I mean, what do you guys think? What is your perfect tablet? And I know it's kind of a fast switch there, but I wanted to bring that up because I really want to know what you guys think. What is your ideal tablet, or what is your main computing device that you want to improve, change, or make better? Now, we're going to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about possibility of having antivirus and malware built onto chips.
Tired of searching the vast jungle of podcasts? Now listen close and hear this out. There's a podcast network that covers just about everything that you've been searching.
Hey!
The Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network is here. Nothing less than a podcast bliss with endless hours of podcast coverage. From news, sports, music, fashion, cooking, entertainment, fantasy, football, and so much more. So stop lurking around and go straight out to the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network. Guaranteed to fill that podcast itch. Whatever it may be, visit us at www.gsmcpodcast.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and download us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Google Play.
Antivirus and anti-malware are also built onto your CPU. Now, that's something they're actually working on right now. And what it would do is anytime the computer or the processor would detect something, it would tell your antivirus or malware of choice and basically say, hey, Bob, we detected this. What do you want to do? Now, the research is underway to develop the process which can help sniff out viruses and providing another line of defense against malware aside from traditional antiviruses. The project, which is a partnership between researchers at Binghamton University and UC Riverside in the U.S., has a research grant of $275,000, roughly around £220 for our European listeners. Now, if the processor picks up anything which might deem it suspicious, it can either alert the security software on the PC or it can investigate itself. Like I said in the beginning, I think what it's probably going to do is it's going to go with the software. I'm more a little iffy of having my CPU flashed because I'm not quite sure how you would actually upgrade the software. I guess in theory you could have like an SSD or something built onto the motherboard that it would store definitions in. Just seems a little fishy with me on that. I don't know. I don't need a virus to nuke my antivirus, especially when it's attached to my motherboard. The processor apparently used low-complexity machine learning to better hone its efforts in terms of attempting to spot malicious attack activity. I don't know. This whole thing is interesting. I want to see how well it works, but let's just say I'm a tad bit of a skeptic. I mean, I've heard of stuff like this before. This is the first time I've ever heard of them trying to attach it to a processor. I've heard of routers and switches and stuff having firewalls and having those firewalls detect viruses and malware. The other question, is this going to be like an Intel CPU or is it going to be an additional thing? Now, it doesn't say in the report I read, and maybe it's deeper in it than I really saw. Now, I'm thinking, I don't know, part of me thinking it would have to be an add-on chip. Would Intel be okay with somebody messing around with one of their processors and doing that? I don't know. I think this is going to be an add-on chip, and if it is, hey, I'm cool for it. I'd love to see it work anytime I can help my friends or my parents actually fight off malware. God knows, with a lot of people don't update their antivirus, because I do know people that don't have internet. So the only time they're able to go to the internet is when they go to the coffee shop, you know, and so what they normally do is they turn off all the updates because as soon as they get connected to the internet, their hardware, whether it's their phone or laptop or tablet, is downloading like 300 gigabytes worth of updates. So a lot of people I know who do that just turn that off. They don't care. However, if the processor can actually detect malware by learning about it and by basic definitions, I'm all for it because honestly, that's less work I have to do and less time I have to spend fixing it. And I know it may seem a little selfish, but when I have somebody's only way to access the internet and their only source of computing, I want to get that done as fast as I can. And like I've told you guys before, it's literally taking me weeks of hours or two, you know, of spending an hour or two a day trying to fix somebody's computer. I mean, it's not always the easiest thing, especially when they don't want you to reformat and start over. So now Dish has recently lost 116,000 TV subscribers last quarter. And that's not particularly surprising. As time goes on, a lot of the satellite providers' prices have gone up. Not as much as cable, I think, but it's still expensive. I mean, if you want all the packages, I bet you could be easily spending $200 or $300 a month just on television. Now they do have Sling TV, which is an additional thing they do that lets you kind of watch live TV and other things. I'm actually going to be testing out this December. So according to Dish's latest earning calls, the company lost 116,000 paid TV subscribers last quarter, including additions to Sling's overall subscriber base. That said, the 116,000 loss was actually less than the 142,000 Wall Street analysts expected. Now that's bad when, you know, you have Wall Street saying, hey, you guys are going to lose this much. Well, many departures are thanks to cord cutters fleeing elsewhere and increasing streaming competitors. Dish tried to claim the stricter consumer acquisitions policy and increased focus on acquiring higher quality subscribers were blamed for the decline. It's marketing speak, so that we're trying to do something different. I think it's because of the fact people like me are tired of spending $200 or $300 a month on television when we only have a couple of hours to watch it. Why do that when you can subscribe to Netflix for like $12 a month, or Hulu or Amazon Prime Video for $99, and then you get free shipping with Amazon? But when people just don't have a lot of time, I can spend $10 and watch, you know, 2 hours worth of video content and I'm happy. I mean, granted, I don't have local channels because where I live, over-the-air TV doesn't work that well. But, you know, there's always ways around everything. I just don't get the point at this point of spending so much money on television. Now, Dish has also lost a net of 20,000 satellite broadband subscribers during the third quarter. Now, let me talk a little bit about satellite broadband. It's a joke. Around here, there's HughesNet and a few other places. Now, a lot of the problem with satellite broadband is it's slow and the latency is insane. And the other thing, a lot of them have caps. There's providers